The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Anyway, we will move on now to something else. And during the week, there was coverage of the Insolvency Service, the ISI. And when the Insolvency Service was initiated, you know, there were the critics, and then there were the supporters of the legislation, and so on and so on and so on. And the ISA kind of came out and said, look, things are going well. And that where some people had said that the banks had a right to veto, saying that this was not being exercised. Now, not everybody shared that point of view. And Conor Pope of the Irish Times Consumer Affairs was writing about it during the week. And you're not one bit pleased with it, Conor.
I think it's going very slowly, and it's going too slowly. I mean, one of the stark numbers that came out of the report that the ISI published this week was about 124 deals were done in the 3 months between the beginning of April and the end of June. And only 27 of those deals involved mortgages. Now, when you consider that 73,000 people are in mortgage arrears of longer than 90 days. If the ISI was to continue at this pace, it would be around 150 years before they had the current batch of crisis mortgages resolved.
Did you do that sum properly?
Yes, I did. It's a very long time. Now, so that's the kind of the bald figure, the top line number. And like, I do have huge sympathy for the ISI because they were coming from a standing start. There was no kind of insolvency service in the Republic of Ireland, despite the fact that there was a pressing need for one for many, many years. And the bankruptcy legislation in this country was arcane.
Draconian,
so,
yeah.
The government has done a lot to repair the bankruptcy legislation.
Yeah.
And it has done a lot to create an atmosphere in which people can apply for insolvency and get through the process. But it's just moving too slowly. Now, on one level, you could say, now, just to put the 124 deals done into perspective, are the 27 deals related to mortgages. The Irish Mortgage Holders Organisation, which, of course, you're very familiar with, it's David Hall's.
Yes.
David Hall is the director. They've done, with two banks alone, AIB and KBC, 268 deals in exactly the same period. So you have the 27 deals involving mortgages done through the ISI, 268 deals done on mortgages, but just on mortgages.
Yeah.
Involving the IMHO. So clearly there's something happening here, and clearly the ISI is moving too slowly. Now, there's a couple of obstacles in the way, but I think that the most fundamental obstacle is consumer awareness, because we still have this guilt associated with insolvency, and people are still burdened by a sense of shame.
Yes.
Because they've overextended themselves, or because they overextended themselves in the boom years.
And so they don't think that there will be sympathy for them saying, you idiot, you know.
Exactly. Now, I think the ISI is doing good work, and I don't want to come in here and just slag them off, because I think it's an important agency. They're doing good work. I'd like to see them doing more. I'd like to see the costs come down.
Talk me through the costs.
Well, there's three types of insolvency out there. There's a debt relief notice. Now, a debt relief notice applies to somebody who has unsecured debts of less than €20,000 and virtually no assets.
A credit card bill?
Credit card bill, credit union loans, unsecured bank loans, car loans, whatever it might be. And, you know, the threshold for getting a debt relief notice is very low. You can't have a €3,000 car, for instance. Your car has to be worth less than €1,000, or actually even less than that. And you can't have a substantial income. So there's a very strict set of rules. And that's for unsecured debt of less than €20,000. And to apply for a debt relief notice, you need, that costs €100. Then if you want to apply for a debt settlement arrangement, now that's for unsecured debt in excess of €20,000, and that's actually unlimited.
Yeah.
And to apply for that, it's €250. And then the key one for the people in mortgage arrears is the personal the PIA, and that you have to spend €550 on your application for that a personal insolvency arrangement.
€550,
which is a lot of money, particularly when you have no money.
This is the point.
And you also have to employ a PIP, a personal insolvency practitioner. And there is the ISI doesn't set the fees for the PIPs, but having said that, you know, they can cost €2,000-3,000 one of these people. That's how much they can charge somebody.
You'd have your 500. And
you have to pay the PIP on top of that. Now, the PIP will say, well, we will take our payment once the deal is done, and the bank will end up paying for it in the long run.
Yes.
But that really hasn't been the experience of people. So there's the cost implication, but I don't think the cost barrier is as important as the emotional or the psychological barrier. And I think if one thing could come out of this programme is if we could encourage more people to avail of the insolvency service of Ireland, because they will help people.
That is government sponsored.
It is a government agency, but I mean, and people do need to be encouraged to use it, because there's nothing more depressing than getting these endless phone calls from your bank or your credit card company or your credit union going, "We need the money," particularly if you don't have the money, because it's just it beats people down. And I don't think there should be any shame attached to being insolvent in this country. And I think one of the things that the ISI has done is it's tried to bring a system about where there is no shame attached to it, because there shouldn't be.
Right. So, why would it be good going so slowly? First of all, perhaps because people are not applying for it, or secondly, staffing, all those kind of things?
Well, they say they have sufficient numbers of staff. They say that one of the reasons why it's going so slowly is they're basically starting from a standing start. So they have to ramp up the whole thing, and that does take time. And, you know, they cite a lack of awareness as one issue. But I think, you know, maybe what's needed is there should be more staff employed by the ISI to fast track the process.
Right.
Because some of the deal, and then, of course, the other issue, and we've talked about this on the show before, is the banks are an obstacle in themselves. Because one of the things that the bankruptcy legislation did was it gave banks an effective veto on doing deals.
Which they denied.
Which, of course, they deny they have. But in the, all told, I think 30% or just over 30% of the personal insolvency arrangements, the deal fell. The deal what didn't get done. Despite someone paying the €550 and getting the debt relief, the protective certificate, the deal failed. Now, that tells me that like up to as many as one in three deals are being stymied by the banks because they're not attractive to them. But having said that, at least the fact that this thing exists means that the banks outside of this system are doing more deals.
Right.
And maybe that's why organisations like the IMHO, IMHO are getting more results.
Okay, listen, before you go, I mean, the Middle East has been in the news. Lord save us, Iran, Iraq, what's going on at the moment in Gaza, and so on and so forth. You are out in the region, now not obviously in Gaza. Last week, was it?
No, it was actually last month.
I travelled
with Medicine Sans Frontières
to
Jordan.
Organization.
They're an amazing organisation, and I think they're an organisation that deserves our 100% support for a couple of different reasons. A, they're an it's very easy to see what they do. Like a lot of NGOs, it's a kind of a labyrinthine system that they're working in, and you don't know where the money is going. When it comes to the MSF, you know, they are the people who are on the ground working in the worst, most hard and difficult circumstances you can possibly imagine. They're on the ground in Gaza now, and they're finding it very difficult to keep their clinics open, but they're finding it very hard to get patients into the clinics because of the bombing. They're doing tremendous work in Syria, in Jordan, and
with the
Syrian refugees. And the scale of that conflict is just unimaginable. I mean, I know all the attention this week has been on Gaza.
Yes, of course.
But over 150,000 people have been killed in the conflict in Syria. There's 2.5 million refugees outside of the country. There's 10 million people from Syria who are internally displaced, and there's 200,000 people who just disappeared. They don't know, there's no record of them. They don't know where they've gone. So that's the scale of the crisis that MSF is dealing with. And when I went there, I travelled to 3 or 4 different places around Jordan with them. And, you know, the first place I went was a town called Ramatha, and it's only about 5-6 kilometres from the Syrian border. And that's where the worst of the war wounded come in. And the medics on the ground were telling me was they're seeing injuries on a scale that they've never seen before. Because if you're dealing with the conflict in Sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, the types of injuries tend to be fairly, I'm going to use the word advisedly, they tend to be fairly basic, you know, knife wounds, gunshot wounds. But in Syria, what they're seeing are huge numbers of blast victims. And, you know, and that's what MSF specialise in there. So the people who are coming in, they've lost limbs. I saw an awful lot of people with external fixators. Now, I didn't know what an external fixator was until I was there. And it looks like this crude metal brace that's attached to your leg. But what it is if your bones have been shattered in so many pieces, conventional setting methods don't work. So what MSF do is they use almost like a scaffolding outside your leg, and they attach bits of your bone to the external fixator, and then they hope it'll fuse in time. An awful lot of people had those kinds of injuries. And then, so I spent some time there, and then I went to one of the refugee camps. It's a refugee camp called Zaatari. And when you hear about them on the news, you don't appreciate the scale of these things or the longevity of these camps, because you think, oh, the refugee camp, they'll be there for 6 months, for a year.
Yeah.
Zaatari, there's 100,000 people there. It's bigger than Cork, 120,000, 130,000 people. And MSF have opened a field hospital there. And most of the victims that come in, obviously, blast victims from the conflict. And, you know, I spoke to all these young guys, and they were like in their early 20s. And like one guy, he'd lost his leg in a he was struck by a tank shell. Another guy had lost both his legs, and he'd lost his four brothers in the conflict. And what was terrible for me when you're talking to them, they don't get this. They still haven't grasped what has happened to them. Like one of the chaps who'd lost one of his legs, he was hoping to go back to Syria and, you know, resume
start
the struggle or start his life or whatever. And they don't appreciate, but they don't appreciate what's happened to them. But what was amazing about the MSF staff is they never ask any questions about where these people
politics
have come from. Because they might be looking after people who are, you know, from one side of the conflict on one bed and another side of the conflict in the other bed. But MSF, they don't ask that. They rise above politics and all those circumstances. But I mean, having spoken to the staff, it was like, you know, I was, because I had to be perfectly honest, if I was in a scenario like some of those staff were working in, or I would be absolutely terrified. Because, like, you know, particularly when they were working in sub-Saharan Africa, I spoke to some of the people there who'd just come back from Central African Republic. And they put themselves in positions which are absolutely terrifying for normal people. But they managed to deal with it in a really calm, measured and professional way, because their constant mantra is, we have to be professional, we can't let people down, right, we have to protect our staff. I spoke to one guy and I said, do you ever get scared? And he went, of course. Last year, some rebels in the Central African Republic broke into his hospital. They were all pointing Kalashnikovs at him and his staff. And he said, my only goal was to get them out of there. And when they're trained very well, so that when you're in a situation like that, they say, you give the rebels whatever they want. You just give them whatever they want. And in this circumstance, the rebels wanted their cars. So they ransacked the hospital, they broke all the medicines and whatever, and they intimidated all the patients and the staff, and then they wanted the cars. So the head of the MSF mission was like, here are the keys, take the keys, just go, go, go. And as the rebels were leaving, he had the presence of mind or the bravery to walk out and say, listen, would you mind taking the stickers, the MSF stickers off our cars? Because I don't want people to die in cars driven with MSF stickers. And I was thinking, God, that shows real guts, because I wouldn't have done that. I would have come and gone, go, please, go, go, go. And of course, they didn't take the stickers off, and they went off and they were shooting people. But, you know, what is striking about the Syrian conflict for the MSF volunteers that I spoke to is that it's very similar. The context is very similar to us. When you go to sub-Saharan Africa, it's very hard for a person from the developed world, from Europe, to put themselves in the position of somebody who's living in some small little village in the Central African Republic
area,
or a remote area. But they could all identify with the victims of the Syrian conflict. And I spoke to a couple of the refugees. I spoke to quite a few of the refugees, but they're no different from their lives. Pre-conflict was no different from your life or my life. One chap was, and he was like, he's now living in a little tent in Zaatari, and he was talking about the fact that he had this lovely house and he had two cars, and he was a professional, and his child was in private school, and his life, as he described it, was paradise. And now suddenly all of that has been taken away from him, and this conflict is just going to go on and on and on and on and on.
Absolutely. We would love to hear more about it. Indeed, I don't know how they manage. I don't know how they manage at all. But anyway, listen, that's a fair cry now from where we started. But anyway, Conor Pope, thank you very,
no
very much indeed. Thank you.